Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
Most of Wall Street right now paints a fairy tale picture for everybody, and everybody wants a fairy tale outcome, but that's not what history teaches us happens. You have to be resilient across a full cycle. It's easy to make money. It's hard to keep it.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this next episode of Finance U, where we decode what's happening in the financial world so you can understand it, maybe take some actions. Back again with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Paul, good to see you.
Good to see you as well, Chris.
Well, we're going to jump right in today because, wow, there's so much news to cover. You saw the jobs revisions, right, Paul?
Oh, yeah.
Somehow, magically, when they revised the job numbers, 911,000 jobs stripped away in the year that ended in March. So March to March, 24 to 25. A lot of those jobs are stripped out in the Biden era. Here's how the Wall Street Journal put it. They said, well, pace of job growth was significantly weaker than reported. You don't say. Good use of passive language on that one. The U.S. added 911,000 fewer jobs over the 12 months that ended in March. The BLS said, trimming by a bit more than half the 1.79 million jobs the official data now show. And if that holds, it would bring the average pace of seasonally adjusted employment from 147,000 jobs a month to a bit over 70,000. Seems important. And they say here, what do we have? Here's the code. Leisure and hospitality, which includes businesses like restaurants and hotels, likely had 176,000 or 1.1% fewer jobs in March. That's a lot. The BLS reported other sectors registering significantly fewer jobs included retailing, professional and business services, wholesale trade, manufacturing, and in percentage terms, the information sector, consider that with all our AI stuff going on, registered the biggest hit by total number of jobs lost. This was the largest revision going back to 2000, so biggest oops ever. When measured by percent of total jobs lost, the revision represents the largest since 2009. And if you want to look at it like this, Zero Hedge put it well, it means there was virtually no job creation last year of the Biden administration, and the Fed maybe should have started cutting in February, saying maybe Trump was right. Too late, Powell. Paul, there's no excuse for missing that badly that I can think of that's legit.
No, and especially not in today's society with the technology we have and ease of access to information. You know, the only reason to have all these delays and obfuscated information is just so you can project a narrative with the administration that's what they want things to be, not necessarily what they actually are. And the problem is the market, especially these algorithms and these trading programs, go off the headline numbers and are maneuvering on the market. So it sets us up in a very precarious situation for the average investor who just has no clue what's really going on.
Well, you remember this, right? So we talked about this. I pulled this from we talked about this before, right? The BLS would come out with these amazing job numbers, and then a couple months later, they'd revise them down. This thing we're talking about is what's called a benchmark revision, which is on top of these other revisions, right? So remember, it was like under Biden, like, oh, 200,000, 250, 300 revised down. When you're revising 13 out of 16 months, you're doing it wrong. Right.
Right.
That suggests to me that these numbers by the BLS were more of a political narrative than reality.
Right. Exactly. Just to paint a picture for what? Political purposes?
Mm-hmm. I mean, during an election year?
During an election year, wouldn't that be considered election interference by a government institution? Is the way you would look at it. Now, Bloomberg chief strategist Anna Wong did some interesting analysis, and she states, you know, because one of the things we look back at September of last year going into the election, you know, the Fed comes with this surprise 50 bips rate cut. So she states that when you look back at the numbers and the revisions, that it's highly likely that the U.S. entered a recession at some point in 2024, and the Fed cut rates dramatically in September to try to, you know, stop the decline. Well, on the other side of that, so let's say they actually had that information. It wasn't just a political move. Obviously, it was a political move if they're not going to follow through with the data we're seeing now. But she's stating that that likely supported the employment market. And then we get into February, and it looks like we started to roll over into a double dip recession at that point, but yet the Fed refuses to cut rates. Now, I'm not a proponent of cutting the rates right now, specifically because of the asset price inflation it'll bring. But if you're looking at the measure and the SOM rule and the things that they're looking at, it literally does make sense. And the argument at the end of the article was put out was, you know, hey, is Powell actually playing politics? Because if we look back in this data, huge payroll revisions historically have been recessionary indicators.
No, absolutely. And so this is just shenanigans, right? And the BLS, I have so much scorn for that government agency because of what they do with querying the inflation statistics and then these jobs. Like my biggest complaint about their methodology in jobs has been, well, you know, there's two surveys and they have a household and an establishment, that means businesses, but can't really trust businesses because, you know, they're dying and forming all the time. So they have this model called the birth death model, which is supposed to try and take a stab at how many businesses have been created in the period they're looking at, because you know what, they might have been formed and hired people, but they wouldn't see it. Like, well, then just wait, right? Because you know what, if they hire people, you're going to have W-2 data like next month, right?
That's right.
It just wait. They never wait. They try and model it. Their model is always wrong to the upside. And it has a complete bias in it, and it gives us this garbage on the back end. But there's no accountability. Nobody gets in trouble for that stuff. I know Trump fired the BLS head over this stuff, but this is garbage data right here.
It is
politically
garbage
biased garbage data. Yeah.
It's a narrative for one side versus the other, which is a further indication that, hey, you know, the deep state or whatever's got this narrative behind the scene that they're trying to work with. And it just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, you know, as an employer, you've got payroll data that has to be reported, has to be paid in. I don't understand why they don't just pay attention to payroll data, because small businesses are going to have to make, so let's say some are a little bit behind, but that's still data that comes into the government coffers on a regular basis that can be tracked instead of these arbitrary numbers that can be manipulated for political purposes. We know it takes place in the CPI as well. And with the speed of information and the ability that we have to gather information today, there is no excuse to have all of these supposed models. I get it 50 years ago, 75 years ago, when you didn't have access to data like we do now, but computing power is relatively easy with all these incredible chips we have. We should be able to get as close to real-time data with a two-week lag. Let's say it's a 30-day lag with payroll information or receipts that are coming into the government. It should be easy to track.
It should be. But they're resistant to doing that, and they have been for a long time, because, again, I believe it became politicized, right? And this is under many administrations, but obviously things, I think, have been getting more and more politicized over time, particularly under Biden. Things got just ridiculously politicized in all dimensions. The Wall Street Journal gave us a decent chart, which shows, I think you can see here, the annual job revisions, changes in jobs from a year earlier. So we're revising our job growth down enormously through this whole period. But this is the trend. The trend is clear. Things are getting weaker and weaker. And what's fascinating is that, you know, all of this stuff that we've been talking about, where the Trump ascent plan is, we're going to grow this from the bottom line, right? We're going to, we can't cut spending. So we'll grow the bottom line with manufacturing as the core of that narrative. I know it's early yet to declare victory or loss in this whole thing, but we're seeing sustained weakness here in manufacturing employment. So maybe we're bringing in manufacturing that doesn't need employment, and that opens a different conversation about what kind of a culture and society we're going to have. But by the numbers, manufacturing has been really struggling here in the U.S. for a couple years now. By the numbers.
It has. Yeah, by the numbers. And granted, any policy is going to have some type of lag effect, lag impact. But here's my question. At the first part of that chart, 2021, you've got all of the cash that was just flushed into the economy, and that started the housing boom, right? You know, the housing euphoria or speculation. So you got all this construction that's starting out under place. And look, I'm talking to people all over the country right now, and I know there are places that housing is still going strong, but for the most part, it's frozen. So you've got all of these aspects of the economy that are frozen, that all of this debt, the lower interest rates, debt accumulation, capital that's pushed forward has pulled forward future demand. It's just harder to continue to grow at a high pace right now. And we're clearly seeing in the revisions that things are slower than anybody anticipated, but the market doesn't seem to care at this point.
Well, I want to talk about that and get to that, because I think I have an explanation, at least for part of it. Zero Hedge also reported it was actually worse than even the headline, because in the most recent report, full-time jobs went back by 357,000, while part-time jobs went up by 597,000. So when you wanted to talk jobs, it was all part-time, right? And obviously part-time jobs is when people are struggling, the economy's not doing that good, so they have to take a second part-time job, or employers aren't feeling all that confident, so they're not willing to risk taking on full-time employees, so they part-time it. So full-time jobs are still in decline, and they have been for a couple months now. You know, they've been basically in retreat for two of the last 3 months. So
what I really wish they would break down the information for, and there's no reason that they can't, is I want to know the people who have full-time jobs that are taking extra part-time jobs to try to cover the cost of living increase that's taken place in their insurance, their taxes, their health insurance, and just expenses across the board.
Quite oddly, I don't have a chart on this, but they just came out and said, the producer price index was a big downward miss, you know, so inflation is really moderating at this point in time. I don't understand that. I'm going to call BS on the BLS on that one, too, at this point, because that doesn't track with a lot of things I'm hearing from people, where the tariffs are actually hitting import prices, and they must be stripping that out in some way, right, I guess, and nothing is falling yet, except lumber prices, but I haven't seen it really on the producer side that we're seeing a lot of, at least the things I'm intimately familiar with, oil, gas, construction, the rest, I don't know. You know, maybe something's going on in auto parts, but you wouldn't know it looking at the price of new cars these days.
No kidding. It's incredible. But there's also problems. I mean, if we go back and look right now, speaking of the auto market, and I know I'm taking a tangent here. Let me find the chart. Okay. Here it is. Auto loan delinquency rate is the highest in 14 years now. Mm-hmm. So if you go back and take a look at that, I mean, that prices may be holding up, but there's a lot of weakness under the surface right now. So bar chart puts this out. This goes back to 2012. I mean, look at this. That's a substantial increase right there. Now,
is that all auto loans? That's not just subprime, because I've heard that subprime is a component of that is doing really bad.
Like, yeah, subprime is really struggling at this point. But this, I would assume this is all auto loans.
Yeah, I think so.
Loans are considered delinquent 30 days, seasonally adjusted, source Federal Reserve Bank of New York credit panel. So I'm assuming that is all. Mm-hmm. And then you've got other issues that are taken. I thought this was pretty interesting if you go to the car market. So a car dealership guy, I like following him.
Oh, yeah, he's good.
Long.
Yeah.
So listen to this. This is news that came out. Subprime lender Tricolor Auto just hit pause on critical operations. Okay.
Oops.
On Friday, an unidentified bank took control of the used car giant, suspending sales across Texas, Arizona, and California. By the end of the day, 80 to 90% of employees were told they were on temporary leave, not fired, just waiting until October 6th to find out if they'd return. Emails shut off, salaries frozen, stores dark. For now, workers keep their health insurance. But with about 65 retail centers and $5 billion in auto loans on the books, borrowers are left wondering who's servicing their accounts. And that uncertainty cuts deep, which is true. because TAG's focus on Hispanic and ITIN borrowers leaves it especially exposed as tighter immigration enforcement collides with the risks of subprime lending. So, you know, who knows what happens October 6th, but quite frankly, that uncertainty is going to cause some damage in the overall market in general. But, you know, you've got, you know, it's kind of like housing. I'm hearing individuals, you know, prices are frozen, and there's all kinds of memes that are popping up making fun of your homeowners that are going, well, we'll cut the price 2%, right? Real estate agents are saying, you know, you need to cut the price some. They're like, what do you want me to give it away? There's some hilarious memes out there if you guys have seen those. But then, but what's concerning to me is I'm talking to people all across the country. Now, Northeast, a little bit different, okay? But if you're talking Texas and Florida, even areas in California right now, there are people that are on the leading edge. I'm having conversations with people that are a little overlevered, and I'm like, hey, you know, you need to cut that price. If you, if you're not in the position to sit on this thing for 2 or 3 years, you need to be the first to cut to see if you can get a bid. Some of these people are cutting prices 20, 25, 30%, and they're still not getting activities of looking at it are going up, but they're still not getting offers, and the market's still frozen. So at some point, something is going to crack, and I'm really concerned in the next 60 to 90 days. Who knows, right? There's enough euphoria out there that we might navigate this perfectly. The Fed may cut rates. That may ignite another 12 to 24 months, but it's not going to stop the inevitable because we've pulled forward so much demand. Something is going to crack at some point, and the longer this goes, the more damage it's going to do to the oblivious investor.
I agree, but you know, this is, as you mentioned, like a Fed rate cut really just inflates asset prices. So this is really a tale of two worlds. It's the people who own assets versus the people who don't. And they try and say, oh, 56% of households own stocks. Like, no, 90% of stocks are owned by 1% of households, right? So it's not that big, broad 56% they try and shape it as. But of course, what do you wake up to? All three major stock market indexes close at records on hopes for deeper rate cuts, right? So this is again like, oh, we're going to get more sugar in the punch bowl. Come on, you know, come on, Jerome. Baby needs new shoes, you know, throw it. So I want to talk really quickly a couple of reasons why stocks are going up. One of them bothers me a lot. And this is buybacks. So stock buybacks. These are the stocks benefiting the most, according to Barron's, right? So look, they say they're returning cash to shareholders. Again, broken record time here. This is not how you return cash to shareholders. There's a process. It's called dividends. What you're doing when you're buying back stocks is you're actually pretending like you're giving money to shareholders, but you're not. You're usually just buying back shares that you diluted by handing them off to your CEO. So this, to me, is just a poorly disguised compensation package dressed up as a benefit for shareholders. It is not.
No. No. What was it? Prior to 1982, buybacks were illegal. I mean, I understand that there are minor percentage situations where it makes sense to buy back stocks, but I believe that it's something that should be voted on by the shareholders, not left to the C-suite with all of their compensation being in stocks, where
great
buybacks
point.
Are continuing to drive the stocks higher.
Totally agree. And by the way, there were a lot of people out saying, oh, you know, the Fed should have cut. He's too late. The Fed should cut. Listen, all this hoopla about a potential of a 0.5% cut, as you and I have pointed out before, financial conditions have been easing strongly since 2023. A Fed rate cut is supposed to be easing. They're saying, oh, the Fed's tightening. There's no tightening going on. Financial conditions have been getting easier. So this whole, all this talk even about should the Fed cut, should they not cut, half a point, quarter point, I consider it irrelevant because procedurally, when the Fed cuts now, they're not actually withdrawing or advancing cash into the market anymore. They are literally just changing how much interest they pay to banks for excess reserves they hold with them. That's it. So it doesn't actually do anything to put more or less financial conditions, but everybody focuses on it. The Fed rate cut tells us it signals something. It's a market signaling device. But procedurally, it doesn't do anything anymore. What I care about is our financial conditions getting easier or harder, and they've been easing a lot, and we've been seeing that in the financial prices of assets, and it's already wicked easy. I don't think it needs to be easier at this point, personally.
No, and easing financial conditions are more important than what interest rates are. And this is a perspective I'll share with the listeners out there. So I've had the, you know, in 27 years of doing this, I've been very fortunate just to get to know people. And I always like, especially after we've established a relationship, you know, what did you do good in your life and what did you do wrong? So there's a, now this guy is not a Ken McElroy real estate legend, right? But for the 80s and 90s and 2000 in a small town with an eighth grade education, this guy built a mini empire in a small town in real estate. And we were talking in 2006, 2007, 2011, 2012. He passed away around 2018. I asked him, I said, so what was it like in the early 80s when you were building spec houses, you know, and interest rates were 17 and 18%? He said, quite frankly, money was so easy to get and the banks were so happy to give it to you. He said, that's how I actually got my start, was because money was easy. He said they had enough margin for error. Inflation was relatively low on that side, you know, at that part of the cycle. He said, I could go borrow as much as I had the willingness to pay. He said, so it was actually a lot easier then than it was in the 2012, 2013 period when interest rates were real low, but the banks were hesitant to lend money out. So, you know, that tells you right there that loose financial conditions are more important than what the rate situation is, and that's inflationary. Now, with that being said, I've got a theory I want to share with you, and I want to work
through. All right, all ears.
And we've not talked about this yet. So, Samantha Leduc, when interest rates first started rising, said something that was completely opposite of the conventional wisdom. She said higher interest rates are going to be inflationary because corporates and households have locked in low rates. Corporates issued a ton of debt, long-term debt at low interest rates, and they are sitting on a lot of cash. And as soon as they start earning more than what they're paying out, that's going to give them extra capital for stock buybacks, reinvestment, and whatnot. So Zero Hedge comes out with an article yesterday or today. I'm going to share my screen with you, and then I'll go back and talk you through this image. So let me give them credit on that. So it's the next Fed cutting cycle won't be for your benefit. So if we go back and look and remember what Samantha Leduc said, the change in annual net interest received since the Fed started raising rates in March 22. So this is corporates right here. So they actually received positive interest, and we started seeing that on the cash balance and income revenue for the corporations because the interest rates got above what they had locked in their 30-year debt. Banks got positive cash flow in there, and look at households. So you had a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of people that are out there that got scared of the market, that parked their funds back in treasuries or wherever back in 2014, because understandably they didn't think we'd make it this long. They just didn't have a strategy to help them know when to allocate that capital. But, you know, they're getting more money. So we started seeing that in some of the cruise stocks that came in. I remember Royal Caribbean's one that came into one of our portfolios, and I'm like, well, we're going to buy it because it clears our rules, but this is going to be a, you know, we're going to look like fools by the time we exit with a little loss. But what we discovered is the baby boomers getting all of this extra interest on their cash. You know, they had adjusted their budgets with interest rates being low for so long, so they went cruising like crazy. But look at what the government's received. Okay, yep. So negative $550 billion because they were too foolish to lock in that long-term debt. Another chart that they show in that same article is only the government's having a harder time from higher rates. So U.S. banks net interest, this is going back 1985. Oof, that proved a little bit, right? So if you look at corporate net interest received, which would be in the black line, that had declined. That's increased a little bit. You look at all households, they have benefited. And then this blue is the government. Look just how substantial that decline has been.
Oof.
Yeah. So my question is, let's say Trump gets what he wants and he lowers interest rates. So if you consider that perspective from what Samantha Leduc's saying, that's a tremendous amount of capital that's going into the economy that's going to be coming out at this point, right? So inherently, that should be less inflationary, if not deflationary. The question is, what's the Trump administration going to do? If rates go down, are they going to take that savings and reduce our national debt? Or are they going to just turn around for, you know, the opposite of short-term pain for long-term gain and just fiscally pour money into the economy over the excuse of the midterm elections or whatever and further exacerbate the situation for our future generations? To be determined. So what do you think about that? Do you think lower interest rates might be somewhat, pulling capital out? What's your opinion of that?
Yeah, because what happened is we had a Treasury Fed hybrid, right? We talked about it before as passing the baton back and forth, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happened? Well, we took a former Fed chairman, Janet Yellen. Peter principled her right into a Treasury secretary position, but she knew some stuff that she was doing. Basically, they're like, oh, well, the Federal Reserve is now tightening. It's reducing its balance sheet, but they just passed the baton. And the federal government started in this huge, giant emitting machinery where, because of those high interest rates that the Fed had just raised, the Treasury is now in the business of spitting out $1.2 trillion a year in interest payments. Those are going out, like you said, to corporations, to households, to wherever, foreign people. Doesn't matter. That's a particle emitter that's throwing huge amounts of cash into the machine. Yeah. Well, as soon as you start lowering rates, if the government can bring its, and it's, there's a big lag on that because, they have to issue new debt and retire old debt and it takes time. So even if the Fed went to zero tonight, the federal government would still be spending about $1.2 trillion a year, right? Until they manage to roll debt. But still, as soon as the government isn't doing that, surprise, that's when the Fed has to step back in and start doing its money printing. They're both money printing. It's just a little bit of leisure demain, a little bit of like pulling a rabbit out of the hat. Little magic trick there. But if you understand it, yeah, this has been enormously liquefying. That's why markets are as high as they are right now.
Right. And you've got it. And then the psychology behind, you've got the passive investor that's frozen, right? The market continues to go up.
Yep.
Even the individuals who recognize that this is unsustainable. And what's interesting to me is a lot of retail individuals are like, this doesn't make sense to me, but I'm really happy about it. Okay. And then, so you've got that taking place. And all the while under the surface, there's this creeping, rotting and creaking and popping, as you've called it. And our foundation's getting weaker and weaker and weaker. Mm-hmm. So is low interest rates going to help the fact that in Atlanta, there's something, especially Midtown. I don't know if we had talked about this before, but I was having dinner in a restaurant close to Midtown, Atlanta. And, we were talking about the cost of living with one of the servers in the nice little restaurant, and I asked him why they chose that area. And he made the comment that all of these apartment buildings, high rise apartment buildings, have been built up around. And he said, talking about cost of living, he said, a lot of the servers here are moving into that building across the street because they're offering 4 months free rent right now.
Ooh, four months.
4 months free rent. Now, Ken McElroy's talked about that several times. If you're having to offer 4 months free rent. Now, if we do have an excess supply in a lot of these areas, I know there's still a tremendous amount of money going into apartment buildings. I know there's people that are continuing to build rentals because they've taken the most recent past and projected in the future. And we're back to that 2007 consideration of, well, they're not making any more land, right? I can't tell you how often people are saying rental rates will not go down. Well, if the higher cost of living, higher taxes, higher insurance, lower purchasing from tenants on the VRBOs, then that potentially frees up supply. You've got, you've got interest rates. Even if they go down, there's a lot of people continuing to hold right now in a frozen market. Something has to break. Either salaries have to go up or prices have to come down to make it affordable again. Mm-hmm. And people are so flush with cash in a lot of circumstances where they're just refusing to adjust prices, or they don't believe that we're going to go back to that again. And the one thing that I want people to take into consideration is the moment that you believe you're in a bulletproof situation is the moment that you're at the greatest risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because we should, with fear and trembling in this environment, take each step and consider our situation so that if it's not what we anticipate happening, that we're mentally strong enough not to sell at the worst time. That's why I believe you should have a strategy to tell you when to enter and exit. But, markets are at all-time high. Yes.
I need to add one more moving variable in your housing, which is, and I don't have good data for this, but it's just sort of a suspicion. But once the flood of illegal migrants across the border slowed to a trickle, And the flood started to ebb out a little bit with some returns going home. And I don't know how many people self-deported. I think the actual number of physical deportations is just a rounding error at this point. But still, you know, you might imagine that a lot of these new entrants to the country, they come into what's called C-class housing, right? But because they've occupied that, well, then that sort of bumps people up who otherwise would be there. They go into the B-class housing, and then there's the A-class. And so as that C-class starts to maybe hollow out again, people will natively go back down into a more affordable situation. So that could be bringing downward pressure. All these people thought that they had bulletproof B and A-class, you know, sort of like can't lose apartment buildings. Next thing you know, they're offering 4 months free rent, which Kenny McElroy would tell you is a pretty severe sign of distress that you miscalculated somewhere in your earlier spreadsheet about the prospects for that building.
Yes, yes. Now, to be fair, Kenny talked about it Limitless that he's actually deploying capital for the first time in quite a while, but he has a strict formula based on cash flow that he stays within. So not necessarily everything is all bad, but the reality is you're right. People are moving. I mean, moved from one apartment to another to get better rates, more space, more privacy, better location with lower rental. So, mm-hmm. you know, but it takes time to work its way through the system. Real estate tends to move slow. It moves a lot slower than what stocks do because it's harder to liquidate a position quickly. But my concern is we're just to the point that okay, what's going to reignite housing? Will lower rates do it? Well, not necessarily if immigration is increased lack of immigrant renters and increased demand is lowering the supply of people the demand of people who are wanting to rent, which increases the supply. And then again, you know, at what point do things break? I mean, you look at, you know, I have clients that have 30-year HVA systems, 30 years, but I've got clients that are in the HVA business and they're like, Paul, these things don't last more than 10 years anymore, right? And they're expensive. Mm. So you've got a lower quality product that doesn't last as long, which benefits corporate, you know, profits because they're selling more things quicker. You've got insurance costs going up. You've got tax rates going up. All of that's going to take some time to reduce. So I don't think that we're at a situation now to where there's any easy out. And my concern is the market is completely oblivious to the risks that are under the surface. We're moving more on euphoria and fear of missing out and a full belief that the Trump administration and the government is not going to allow anything to happen. But it's a complex system and they're not all powerful. So well, I'm not saying investors have to go sell everything, but you better be ready if you don't have a strategy to control your emotions, if things don't pan out the way that you think they will. Because if you get in a situation where you're making emotional decisions, you're going to make some bad decisions.
Yeah, as always. Paul, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to go into this and I want to talk about some of the additional pressures that are coming on, but we'll also just, when we come back, the politicization of these BLS numbers, to put that in context so we can understand what's coming next. Are you worried that something really big is about to break and you are unprepared? Hey, it's Dr. Chris Martinson here. What if I told you the collapse isn't decades away, but that it's already started? Cheap energy is drying up. Debt's a ticking bomb. Resources are growing thin. The mainstream's blind, but I'm not. I'm your information scout at Peak Prosperity, digging into the data, web, news, real stories, anecdotes, and showing you the dominoes falling right now. I've tracked this since the original crash course nearly 20 years ago, and I'm not here to scare you, but to wake you. The edge is closer than you think. Subscribe today, get the truth, get prepared before it's too late. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, I want to turn to this now. This is from February of 2024, okay? We're coming into an election season there, right? And Heather Long wrote, "Stepping back, it's truly incredible how strong this jobs recovery from the pandemic has been. 14.8 million jobs added since Biden took office, 5.4 million more jobs than pre-pandemic." That was the spin at the time. I would just like, if you could just eyeball this with me, Paul, if you just followed this trend of jobs, you would see that we're still, even with all that incredibleness, we're under that. But as we just learned, these numbers were truly incredible as long as we use the actual definition of incredible, which is impossible to believe.
I love it, Chris. That is a perfect punchline. Well said.
Yeah, they were truly incredible. I'm with that. But do you remember, like, this is what we had to put up with. Listen up. This is incredible.
I mean, look what we've been able to do. We created 16 million jobs. I mean, real new jobs.
Can you believe that was our president? I mean, now people can look back and go, oh, obviously the signs of infirmity and dementia or whatever, you know, mental decline were there. I cannot, I just look back at this and I'm just like, oh, goodness gracious.
Look what we've been able to do. We created 16 million jobs. We real new jobs.
Paul, if this gentleman comes to my house, I'm going to help him get off my down the stairs. I'm going to have a hand on his elbow, right? Because that's the correct thing to do.
Yes.
But it turned out it was all lies, right? Just pure politicization, just lie after lie. And, you know, way back then, this is in March of 24, you know, CNBC was saying talk of recession is dying down. Why? Because, well, the job market was so strong. And, you know, that's what we had to put up with. So with that, these were heavily politicized. I think it's a shame. I think a lot of bad decisions were made on the basis of this stuff. People were confused. But, you know, people's lived experience, Paul, that you and I have been talking about for the past year was like, why are jobs so hard to find? Why is life, you know, so difficult to afford? Why aren't, you know, it's just not quite adding up, you know? And the reason was is because the lived experience was reality and the rest of it was fake.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, and the thing that frustrated me so much at the time and how there were people on Wall Street that called it out, but not the ones that are benefiting from the euphoria, the asset gatherers that are out there that gives them an excuse to create FOMO to get somebody to deposit money with them, carrying risks that they don't understand, neither they or their advisor understand. It's just the complete lack of honesty in the fact that those jobs were lost because of government mandated shutdowns. Okay. And then those jobs were hired back in the government reopening. That's not job creation. That's job
replacement or reinstantiation,
continuation, maybe. You know, it went from pause back to play. But like you said, even in that trend, there's the trend is softening and beginning to roll over. And, you know, you can see that clear if you could draw a line. That's less than the trend line that was being carried before. So we are not as strong as what we were initially. Yeah. And on top of that, we've got all of this that's going into AI. You've got your attorneys that are getting laid off. AI is deflationary. Obviously, it's impacting the job market. If you're cutting the fat that's out of the system, and we get back to reality, I think we're going to look back, and this is a period of time where it was like an LSD acid trip. Never done it. I've just heard of it.
Yep. Well, speaking of a flashback, which you get off of LSD trips, Paul, I have to talk about this one thing with you, because just this morning I wake up and Oracle jumps 32% in pre-market trading, okay?
Mm-hmm.
32% because, well, the CFO came out and said, we expect, this is a flashback to 2000. I have heard this before. We expect Oracle Cloud Infrastructure revenue grow 77% to $18 billion, with a B, this fiscal year. Then pretty much double, increasing to $32 billion, then $73 billion, $114 billion, $144 billion over the subsequent 4 years. This is just your average. We're going to 10x our revenue almost in 4 years kind of story. And what's funny about that is that their actual earnings that they reported missed expectations for this quarter, right? So 14.9, just under $15 billion expected, $1.47, missed by a penny. So the reality was they just missed earnings, but they said, we're going to go from 18 billion, 32, 73, 114, 144, hike, you know, just... I've heard this before, Paul, and this is neither a recommendation for or against Oracle. I'm just pointing out, this reminds me of eyeballs. I'm here in pets.com on this. This says, we've looked into the future and there's nothing that's ever going to slow down this AI thing. And Not energy, not data center concerns, not the fact that nobody's actually making money at it except the picks and shovels guys, you know.
Right.
You know? I've heard this before.
Look, and Oracle's not a penny stock. I mean, that's unprecedented for a company that's that large. And I really am going to start tracking insider sales here over the next 60 days.
Yeah, please do.
To see what happens, because I want to know, is this an opportunity for them to, you know, and then that's what companies do. If you're a CEO and you're compensated based on how well the stock performance does, you're going to take every opportunity to tout the price of that stock because that's the large percentage of your compensation. So, you know, there's, and I get why they tie compensation to the stock performance, but it goes back to, there's a way that seems right to a man, but in its end leads to death, not necessarily death of the company, but corruption, I guess is the best way to put it.
Well, Paul, so I'm getting echoes of the past in some of the stock market stuff. Listen, I don't want to be a perma bear, all this and that, but I'm not. I'm anti-risk, and it feels like there's risks that, just like in 2000, just like in 2007, for whatever reason, the market is just overlooking it. I came across this, which was, let me go full screen so you can see all this. Somebody had said, hey, these are all broadening megaphone patterns on the German DAX over here. JP Morgan is an individual stock, the NDX down there in the lower left, and then NVIDIA as a single company. And said that the last time we saw broadening megaphone patterns like this again was back in 1929. Mm-hmm. That you see these sorts of things, these big giant swings, and you get the euphoria. But the point of a broadening megaphone pattern is it hits the top line and then falls all the way back down to the bottom line, which is pretty far down there in a lot of cases. And if it really breaks down, it goes all the way back to what we call reversion to the mean, back to some fair valuation, which, again, if the S&P was fairly valued today, meaning pick something, a PE of, say, 15, well, it's going to fall 50-60% if it does that, right? You know, so anyway, just risks out there.
It is. And I mean, and what's important, and that's actually highlighted in the technical analysis of stock trends, even in the ninth edition by Edwards McGee and Bassetti. But I think it's Bassetti. But so the point is it's not something that happens that often. It's something that people aren't paying attention to. But I think it was Oliver was talking here recently. The best way you can explain it is kind of a dazed and confused market, right? It starts to sell off. You set a lower low and then you set a higher high and your trend is broken. But it goes perfectly in line with the euphoria and the late stage investor mental cycle that we go through. I don't have that chart in front of me right now or I would pull it up. We've showed it before. But when you get at the peak, I mean, we're sitting here looking at valuations. I mean, pick your valuation measure. I mean, I'm just going to look at, I'll share one here just to point it out. We've talked about Hussman and his work that's in there. Here's another one. You know, Barchark puts out the S&P 500 price to book value, the dot-com bubble versus now. So we're at 5.1, we're 5.3. Okay. You know, back after the Great Depression, 2.2 was what caused the major issues that we had in the 1970s with the market pulling off. You know, and we just kind of got back to the high end of the range back in 2010 because of all the printing. So you've got a whole generation of investors right now that don't understand history. You've got a whole industry that has a vested interest in not teaching people history. Because if you're an asset gatherer with a large firm, you're compensated to go just gather assets, right? Just gather as many assets as you can. Put it in a cookie cutter modern portfolio theory, and every strategy has its strength and weakness. The strength of a passive strategy is you're going to do exactly what the market does. The weakness is you're going to speculate when you don't even realize you're speculating because you're not paying any attention to the fundamentals of what's taking place under the surface. Then you've got a government that has refused to change the oil in the economy. So let's consider, just so people can understand, a recession is a good thing if they happen on a regular basis. It clears out the dead wind in the economy. So think of it like the oil in your car. Most people change their oil from 3,000-5,000 miles, 7,000 miles, wherever it is, depending upon what kind of oil that you're running. So think of a recession. You got to stop that car. You got to take it out of production. You're going to have to sit there unless you have them pick it up, or if you do it yourself, and you're going to take the time to to change the oil in that engine. It makes that engine last a whole lot longer. But we're in an economy right now that's been 40,000 miles without an oil change, maybe 50. Now, the thing is, we all know that that's not good to go 40 or 50,000 miles without an oil change, and none of us would buy a car that somebody's gone 40 or 50,000 miles without an oil change, but nobody knows the exact mile at which the engine seizes. And that's the best analogy that I can describe of where we are. So you take that backdrop, you've got broadening patterns, you've got auto delinquencies going up, you've got housing that's frozen. And what's our savior going to be? Printing money, right? Can we get away with it without inflation coming through? Because that's already a problem. It wasn't a major problem after the 2008 crisis, but now it is. So have we reached the point of diminishing returns, and have we reached the point to where the medicine exacerbates the problem with the patient? And look, Chris, we've hung out together. I'm an optimistic person. Mm-hmm. I also think there's ridiculous opportunities in emerging markets and certain value stocks. And like if this isn't different this time, and I don't believe it is, it's going to be different in the way that it tops, because you're never going to be able to pick it perfectly in any time. It's just not, because you've got human psychology involved, and how much longer can they kick this can down the road? But the problem is when that money flees out of chasing momentum and the U.S. markets being the only game in town with everything else, there's going to be money and smart money that goes somewhere else. They're going to flee. They're going to flee to the areas that you're not looking at, and they're going to maneuver. So, you know, what I want to point out, and I'll share this again, and I know I've shown this time and time, and I don't know when it matters, but it matters a lot for the investor that's adaptive, is what I'm sharing here is the major indexes going back to January 1st, 2008. Black line is S&P 500. The blue line is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. The green line is the emerging markets, MSCI Emerging Markets Index, and that's the developed. Well, what do most people do, Chris, when they choose their 401k investments? They look at past performance, and they go, wow, that's the best performer, so I'm going to pick that. So what are most people doing? They're ridiculously overweight the S&P. You look at the numbers, global investors are ridiculously overweight the S&P and the NASDAQ. Retirees have the largest percentage of exposure in the market of what we've seen of any other generation going back through history. And very few people have exposure to commodities and emerging markets. Now, if you have been there and you've been buying just on value, they've tested your patience. Mm-hmm. But what I want to go back and look at is, let's take 1990 to 2000. Okay, valuations are matching the 2000 time frame across the board. That was the most expensive. Now, I didn't pay all the money to get daily data, but let's just take it from here, okay? From this point forward, S&P 500 was the only game in town compared to commodities and emerging markets, and a little bit on international. And like you said, that, you know, that reminds you of the eyeball counts and everything that was taking place with corporations at that peak euphoria in 2000. But what happened from 2000 to 2007? Okay, we went through a recession, a minor recession, a 47% decline in the S&P. NASDAQ was down around 80. Yeah, emerging markets went down just as much as the S&P. But they also recovered quicker because they were more fairly priced. There was greater opportunity. The companies that were there were lean and mean because they didn't have all this excess capital and pride. And if you were an investor that just was overweight the S&P, you went nowhere for 7 years. But if you had a trade that could help you adapt, you're up 213 in the commodity index or 155, assuming you got those. But that trend carried a little bit further. So in spite of the major decline that happened to commodities in 2008, if you go 2000 to year-end 2010, the S&P was down 14% over that period of time. Developed markets were down 5%. Emerging markets were up 136 and 227. Now, one common theme was we had a weaker dollar during that period of time, which is what the Trump administration seems to desire. So my argument is, the U.S. markets and some of the developed markets like the DAX in Japan appear to be ridiculously dangerous. There's not a tremendous amount of value in them right now outside of just this momentum may carry longer than you can anticipate. But other markets are once in a 30-year opportunity.
So you said something that's all important. But one piece I want to pick up on at the beginning was, hey, when the smart money, when the big money decides it's time to sort of get out of Dodge, they find a door to sneak out, a door or two. So I want to talk about gold real quick. And I put an exclamation point on it because gold hit another new record high this morning.
Yes.
And so actually, Paul, that we've been repeating that so much, I'm going to bring out the golden parrot.
I love it.
Another new high. Right. But importantly, gold actually took out its January 1980 high on an inflation adjusted basis, according to Bloomberg. That's a big deal because remember, it hit whatever, what did it, 350 or something back then. But anyway, it was, back then that was a big deal. But now at 3,500, it's 3,700 hike. Off you go. So what I wanted to talk about, though, is gold prices in Japan are going even more vertical. According to Katusa Research, and he said, what does this remind you of? Somebody posted the answer to that right under this in a comment, and they said, oh, yeah, kind of looks like gold versus Weimar Germany gold marks back in the day, right?
That's a great chart.
And said, oh, gold's overbought, you know, and then he had to wait another year, be patient. Gold's going nowhere, they said, and then gold is effed over here, you know. Look, it went back down again. And then it goes up and like, oh, gold's going to collapse. I think we're right at this stage, right about here, right? Mm-hmm. That's where we are. So if you're in Japan, you're basically right about here, potentially. And now why would that be? Well, because the Japanese population is declining, it's aging, and their Bank of Japan can't think of anything to do besides more of the same. So they're just printing more money, making more debt, shoving more, you know, things into the market and all of that. And Japan is now, I think, legitimately, Paul, in a little bit of concern, right? Because I think their prime minister just gotten stepped down, and the Bank of Japan, like, they have some issues, but they can't think of anything to do besides more of the same. And next thing you know, you see gold going vertical in yen, and you see that the same thing in other places. Turkey, there's a lot of places where you see the same dynamic. It's not because gold's becoming more expensive. Their currency is busy collapsing.
Yes.
And we've seen this story before, right? And by the way, for anybody watching at home, this is a log chart. So each of these is an increment of 10, more than the last increment, right? We're not quite there yet, but we're getting there. That's what it looks like. So I just thought, yeah, we should have fun with that. By the way, Paul, retail's nowhere in this story. Gold miners, the GDX is outperforming everything again. It's up. You said, you know, what's up this year? Mm-hmm. This is up close to 100% this year, right? At this point, mm-hmm. So again, gold miners, GDX outperforming everything else. But check the fund flows, still deeply negative at -$3.45 billion. So people are cashing it out even as it goes up. In terms of a fund, that's a bizarre thing, a true mystery. Yeah, I like how Brandon Balow put it. He said, bull markets climb a wall of worry, but in this case, it's a wall of disbelief.
That statement is ridiculously important, and I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to say, I had some insight over the past 2 to 3 weeks into the numismatics market, okay? So I've always stayed with your sovereigns, your gold Canadian maple leaves, or my preference, but get your coins. My argument's been they're easily recognizable. There's less chance of fraud. But the numismatics, I've stayed away from. Just didn't understand that market completely. You know, premiums, it's just harder to, it's too obfuscated. But I'm trying to help somebody who got in a situation where they were taken advantage of, and I'm learning about that market. Well, apparently it's very retail investor driven within the United States. And they're talking about how the reason why the prices haven't kept up with Canadian maples or silver American Eagles is because they're typically retail. Big institutions are buying on the other side. Retail's selling quickly. Now, you know, as my radar has been up, I was at dinner the other night and I heard somebody over having a conversation, didn't know who I was or what was taking place. It's just bizarre that I run across these things from time to time. And they're having a conversation that they'd invested in some of these numismatics that didn't perform as good as they thought. So they went ahead and sold them because they thought Nvidia was going to continue to be the new version and Bitcoin's the new gold or whatnot. So what amazes me is gold's continuing to break out. Central banks have more on hand than they do treasuries at this point for the first time in quite some time. I think we showed that chart No, I was trying to find it here a minute ago, a couple of weeks ago. But there's, but retail is frozen to an extent. Like I do not, in 2012, when gold kind of hit its high and you had that euphoria and gold miners were blowing out and we're getting a long-term sell signal from a momentum, I had more phone calls in one day about wanting to buy gold than I did anything else or wanting to add to my positions. I don't have that taking place right now. I mean, I'm still having to talk people into, yes, I do think you need to average in, but I'm still having to really convince people that if it's appropriate for their circumstance, not broad advice, that you need to average in, kind of buy some pullbacks. There's no belief in retail. But the moment that the belief in retail comes at goal, we'll be closer to the top, but that's when prices are really going to move. And when I look at what's taking place in crypto and what I, the more conversations I'm seeking out with kind of the relationships I have in your modern portfolio theory, kind of mainstream Wall Street brokers, is they're euphoric over crypto and the story around that and the AI. And it's the easiest thing for them to gather assets. And they're still making fun of gold being a relic. And my concern is that the crypto euphoria being pushed by Wall Street, being pushed by the government so much, actually provides a relief valve to have money chasing other items while big institutions, big money, and central banks have the ability to try to gobble up all the gold that they can, because they know what they're going to do. And if they just continue to print and destroy our currencies, gold has historically been a good hedge.
Well, not just a good hedge, but this chart alone, right? So this goes all the way back to 1970, okay? So very long-term chart here. And watching gold come out of its technical formation of a cup and handle, this, Paul, tells us everything we need to know, that there is something very big happening. Now, we might not know what that is, but I like the way that Nick, who works with me, put it. He said, you know, you ever play the game Spoons with your kids, right? And you know, when they're unsophisticated, you just grab at the spoons, you know, when you're playing that card game, you know, and it's a big mad dash. But then they get sophisticated, and he said, I feel like somebody's sliding spoons off the table very gently.
Yeah, it certainly appears that way.
And all of a sudden, people figured out the spoons were coming off the table, and boom, here we are, right? So this is really, this is actually a very big deal. Watching gold has been controlled, contained. It's a part of the narrative structure of the central machinery. They had the London Gold Pool. They've been working on using futures to keep its price contained. You know, it's obviously been anything but a barbarous relic. It's caught a lot of official attention, and London and New York have worked very hard to keep it kind of under wraps. But China kept sneaking all this gold off the table, right, and bringing it in. And now this is as close to a mad scramble as I can imagine on a monetary basis. And you just pointed out that now foreign central banks have more gold in their possession on a dollar basis than U.S. treasuries. That's a big deal. This is a big deal. I don't want to oversell it, but I don't want to undersell it. This is a big deal. That's what's happening in gold right now. And I think your average retail investor in the U.S. has zero idea about it, because it's not being written about in those terms in any of the major publications or on TV.
It's not. It's not at all. And there's one chart that I'm wanting to find. And Chris, I believe that, let me see if I can find it in here. I may not be able to. I'm not as calm when I'm trying to find something as you are. I kind of panic look for it. I haven't learned that yet, guys. I will. But so I can't find it, so I'll talk you through it. But when I was doing some counseling, or not counseling, supporting a men's ministry, there was somebody that I knew, cared about growing up, that ended up in the ministry, addiction ministry, and I was heartbroken because that they kept relapsing. So the minister that was there, the counselor, I had the conversation, and I said, look, you know, what is there anything I can do? Is there anything we can do? What we're having hard conversations. You know, my heart breaks for him and his family. And he said, Paul, when the pain of changing becomes easier than the pain of staying the same, then someone will change. And I thought, wow, that's a really good lesson to raise your kids, you know, right? Because you want to give enough pain in a controlled environment for them to change their behavior for the good. But there's a lot of truth in that. So over the years, I've seen the wisdom in that, that when the pain of changing becomes easier than the pain of staying the same, someone's going to alter their path. Now, let's go back to the weaponization of the U.S. dollar and what's taken place with Russia. Trump started it. Biden magnified it. Okay, if you go back to that chart, if I could find it right now, there is a sea change in global and global sovereigns and countries and what they were doing. That's when they really started accelerating the move towards gold. That's where the BRICS have continued to talk about an alternative agreement, a currency, the unit that we've talked about before in the past. So I think we finally got to the point where the pain of changing for the rest of the world was easier than the pain of staying the same. And they're marching in that direction. And look, I don't know what to do with crypto from a standpoint. I do believe that you should take profits. I'm very concerned about MSTR and the leverage. I'd rather own Bitcoin than I would MSTR if I was going to have to own the two because of the leverage situation. But the evidence continues to build because Wall Street's not promoting gold and metals to the average retail individual, but they're promoting a lot the cryptocurrencies and the Bitcoin ETFs that are out there. So I am concerned that that's a relief valve, like I said before, where big institutions can continue to gather it without competing for retail. There you go. You found it. Y'all, mm-hmm. I love the fact that he's able to find these things so quick. I am nowhere near as organized as you are. But that's the chart. I mean, look, yeah. Well, there's another chart that shows it. But really look around, you know, what is that, 2018, that trend went from being flat to starting to accelerate in 2020. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we weaponized our position as a global currency, and that made the pain of moving towards an alternative system easier for the rest of the world. And it's not yep. going to benefit us or our citizenry.
Absolutely. It's a huge deal, and it's a big change. So, Paul, can I switch gears real quickly to, I got one last piece here to go through.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I want to get back. So housing, it's really important. And so you mentioned some moving pieces. I got one more moving piece I want to bring back in sharp relief because, you know, it used to be that your mortgage payment, well, that was the defining thing, right? And so if interest rates went down, rule of thumb, for every 1% it went down, you could afford 10% more house price. Right. So if it went from 6% to 5%, if you could have afforded $400,000, now you can afford $440,000. Right. So that's what I mean by a 10% price because the mortgage payment's equivalent. But as we talked about last time, some people's electricity bills have turned into like a second mortgage payment, right? Over $1,000 a month in some cases, right? There's insurance, and we've talked about this before, house insurance and all that, but if we could. Breaking Unusual Whales just posted on September 8th, a couple days ago at the time of this recording, said breaking Americans are going to face the biggest increase in health insurance costs in 15 years per Financial Times. We talked about this poor lady. She was crying because she said, listen, if I choose health insurance, I lose my house. If I choose my house, I lose my health insurance. Just distraught. Like either way, kind of screwed, she said. And she's resigned and demoralized about this whole thing. She's like, I don't care anymore. Right. So that's how bad it's gotten. Last year, I reported on this that when the BLS finally came out with their, again, the BLS came out with their CPI, Consumer Price Index, they had said that unadjusted percent change from October of 22 to October 23, year over year, health insurance costs, they said, went down 34%. Right. And then just this year, Charlie Bilello pointed out that according to the U.S. government, the cost of health insurance has declined 5% over the past 5 years. It's down 5%. The reality, again, the difference between the statistics and the reality, this is what the average in premium has looked like for a family, and it is nothing but an uninterrupted straight red line up into misery. And so if in 1999 your average yearly health insurance premium for a family was $6,000, in 2023 it was $24,000. That's the reality. So I think when we're talking about things that could actually influence house prices, it's not just the mortgage anymore. It's not just the principal and interest. Now the taxes, real estate taxes going up like crazy, that insurance part, but also not just the direct home insurance, but also auto insurance and health insurance. Like there's all these structural costs you can't do anything about because you have to have them. to have a prudently run household, right? You can't fly naked without, like, how, you know, auto health or house insurance. But people are going to have to start doing that. And again, all of this is just like the cost pressures on a family are through the roof. And I don't care what the BLS just told me about the PPI, right? They that's just another lie at this point, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, you look at the evidence that you just laid out in the facts, and what we should be calling the BLS is the Bureau of Lying with Statistics. Mm-hmm. Is literally what it should be, because I don't know.
Or just take the L out,
from.
You know. We'll just call it the Department of BS. Yeah,
yeah, the Department of Bullshitaki, right? So I couldn't bring myself to say it, guys.
Thank you. Always a gentleman.
Yeah, from that standpoint, I mean, and this was one that I had. I mean, just to further exacerbate, what's going to change this trend right here in higher energy prices? Okay. So the average price of electricity per kilowatt hour in the United States, it's unsustainable from 1980. I mean, look at this lurch forward. You've done a phenomenal job. You know, this is average price of electricity per kilowatt hour in U.S. city average. So what's going to change that? I mean, you've laid out clearly the information that we've been behind on investing into our grid. China's way ahead of us. You've talked about the importance for energy and wealth time and time again. You're educating people for that. These are trends that are not easily solved, especially with the consumption that's taken place in AI. And think about how many of these data centers are under construction who haven't even come online yet. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's going to be increased demand. So we have become so complacent in America that our wealth is going to protect us and that our military power is greater than anything, but pride comes before the fall. And we've taken so much pride in the fact that we're smarter, we're better than everybody else, that it's different this time, that we don't have to learn from the mistakes of the past or learn from the mistakes of others. My concern is that we've got a lot of pain coming because of the weak men and women who've been leading our country. Mm-hmm. And that's my whole job, is to try to help people get through this, to make good, prudent financial decisions. This isn't necessarily a time to where you need to be worried about the return on your capital. You need to be worried about the return of your capital, both from loss of purchasing power from inflation and potential deflation in the short run. So I may be wrong, and our tools will keep us in the right place the large majority of the time. But I'm still concerned that we're going to have a deflationary event before we get that hyperinflationary holocaust that everybody's convinced is going to happen. We know what the response is going to be. But you know, the problem is, if you don't have 12 or 24 months worth of emergency funds, if you haven't swept some of these irrational returns off the top to build your resiliency, what happens if you lose your job and you can't replace it? What happens if your expenses go up more than you think? What happens if you're in a situation where you're forced to sell companies that may not, that may continue to be leaders when they revert back to the mean right at the bottom? I've seen too many people do that in the 2002, 2003 bottom. I've seen too many people that were forced to do that in the 2008, 2009 bottom. And the decisions that led to that major volatility has been capitalized on and doubled down upon. And I don't think we're going to get out of this without paying for those investors who are absolutely oblivious to the risks they're carrying and absolutely oblivious that they're speculators, not investors.
Yes. And if companies insist on returning money to shareholders by buying back the stocks, that would be a good time to sell into that, because of course you don't, no such thing as a gain until you take it.
Right.
You know, so anybody who thinks they have all this money they've earned in the markets, but they haven't taken money out of the markets, the answer is no, you haven't. 100%. And that applies to gold as well as houses, all that stuff. You know, it really doesn't matter until you've actually pulled the trigger and taken the gain. You got to take the chips off the table to have chips off the table, right? It's just part of it. But you're right. So if anybody needs to have, more of a buffer just in case there is this deflationary impulse or costs go up more than we think, or we discover all the ways they've been lying to us is actually creates a fragile, not a robust system, you know, just a time, just good advice. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, and let me take that back. Asset price deflation, not necessarily cost of living deflation.
No, probably not that. Yeah.
Right. I'm not expecting the cost of living to drop dramatically, but I am expecting some asset price deflation before we're out of this. How short it will be, I don't know.
All right. So, Paul, we're going to have to leave it there. And I just wanted to remind people, and thanks for today. This was good. That if you want to talk to Paul or his amazing team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com and you will just click on something to find an advisor. Hey, there's a guy I know, right? And there's a very simple form that can be filled out here. It doesn't take very much time. Click a few buttons, all the usual and important disclosures down below. But importantly, no obligation, no hard sales, just great advice, superior service. And so if you fill out that form, somebody from Paul's team will be in touch with you within 48 business hours to set up an appointment. So I would highly recommend people do that because now would be a good time to get a plan.
Yes. Yes. Let us stress test your situation for you. And I like the fact that you put on there, there's no hard sales. We're not. Like, I only want to work with the people that it's appropriate to work with. And I only want to work with the people that I have the ability to offer some value. And that's not every person that I run across. But when I, you know, if it's appropriate and I take somebody through, the reason I take the time and the advisors take the time to run a plan, our industry doesn't do it because it takes a lot of work to do that. Mm-hmm. But if we don't move any forward and we never talk again, you are better prepared and you understand your situation better and the risks that could take you out than what you are before. So we don't twist arms. You know, I always ask permission. I'm like, there's one of two ways. I can have McKinsey schedule a recommendation meeting, or you can think about it and reach back out to us. And if somebody wants to think about it and they don't reach back out, timing's not right. Maybe it's not a good fit. Maybe they're not ready, whatever. So our number one objective is just to help you become a wiser investor and understand the reality of your situation. Because if you don't understand reality, you might be living in a fairy tale story without realizing it. And that's my concern. Most of Wall Street right now paints a fairy tale picture for everybody. And everybody wants a fairy tale outcome. But that's not what history teaches us happens. You have to be resilient across a full cycle. It's easy to make money. It's hard to keep it.
Well said. Very well said. All right. Well, Paul, I'm going to see you probably in about 24 hours because we're going off to the summit right after this. I can't wait. Really looking forward to that.
I am too.
See you there soon. And anybody watching this who's going to be at the summit, can't wait to see you there. Otherwise, everybody will be back next week with another episode of Finance U.